I am Ted Montgomery, and I'm involved with a men's Bible study, a life group, and also a facilities team here at the church. This morning, I'll be reading from John 9, 1 through 14. As he passed by, he saw a blind man from birth. And his disciples asked him, "Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind?" Jesus answered, "It was not that this man sinned or his parents, but that the works of God might be displayed in him. We must work the works of him who sent me while it is day. Night is coming when no one can work. As long as I am in the world, I am the light of the world." Having said these things, he spit on the ground and made mud with the saliva. Then he anointed the man's eyes with mud and said to him, "Go, wash in the pool of Siloam," which means sent. So he went and washed and came back seeing. The neighbors and those who had seen him before as a beggar were saying, "Is this not the man who used to sit and beg?" Some said, "It is he." Others said, "No, but he is like him." He kept saying, "I am the man." So they said to him, "Then how were your eyes open?" He answered, "The man called Jesus made mud and anointed my eyes and said to me, 'Go to Siloam and wash.' So I went and washed and received my sight." They said to him, "Where is he?" He said, "I do not know." They brought to the Pharisees the man who had formerly been blind. Now it was the Sabbath day when Jesus made the mud and opened his eyes.
Thanks, Ted. Well, one of the things that I've been really convicted by lately is I don't feel like I've been doing a good enough job of drawing attention to who the new members of Calvary Bible Church are. That one of the things that we talk about as we go through the membership class is we say to be a member here is that we are committed. We're committed to the work that God is doing here. We're committed to being part of it to the best of our ability. And we're committed to each other, to helping one another to follow Jesus. Well, if we're committed to each other, well, how is it that we are to know who each other are? If we're to help one another to follow after him, well, how do we do that if we don't know who are we supposed to be helping? And so one of the things that I want to do is whenever we have new members, I want to help draw attention to who they are, to know that this is someone who's helping me follow Jesus, and this is someone as a member of Calvary Bible Church that I am to help them follow Jesus. We have two membership classes throughout the year, and sometimes we have people who want a little bit of time to see, is this truly a place that I want to be a member of, to commit to. And so sometimes we'll have new members trickle in over time. And so this past week, we added two new members of Calvary Bible Church who attend here in Thornton. And so I want to draw attention to them, that Michael and Karen Cloberdans are people that I am a member of Calvary Bible Church and committed to, and they, as new members, are committed to me as well. I think this is a good initial step, but I don't think that it's still far enough. Because as we draw attention in service or in the midweek update, it's not helpful to remember past this day, to keep reminding ourselves, who am I committed to in this time? Well, one of the great resources that we have here at Calvary is a program, a whole system of apps that we call Planning Center. Through it, we basically do everything behind the scenes to make this church function. We plan our worship services in Planning Center. We have our offering go through Planning Center that enables us to do the ministries here. For those various ministries, we have different groups that you can communicate to each other through. We can take attendance. We can send resources out through. Basically, everything that we do behind the scenes runs through Planning Center in some way. It also functions as our directory, that I can go to Planning Center and pull up a list of the members who attend Calvary Bible Church in Thornton. And as I do so, I see, wow, there's 145 members of this church. And that's such a great tool for me. I use it to pray through. I pray for the members of this church. I use it to remind myself, all right, as I see them on Sunday, I should be caring for them, to remember I'm committed to the people on this list, and to be encouraged by, to know that they are praying for me and helping me to follow Jesus as well. Well, how do we know who these 145 people are? Well, that's easy. There's a spot on each of our profiles that we can add a picture, so that way people can see our face to know what we look like, and then when we see them on a Sunday, we can know this is someone I'm committed to and they're committed to me. One small problem to that. As of earlier this week, when I went to look at that list of 145 members, 98 of them did not have a profile picture. And so that is difficult to know who are these members. Who is it that I'm committed to? And so here's a challenge that I'm issuing to those who are members of this church. I'm encouraging you at some point during the week to go to your Planning Center profile. We have some steps that tell you how to locate this. Log into Church Center. It's another name for Planning Center. You can go to your profile and you can upload a picture there. You click on the circle that's your profile, and then on the next slide, it tells you how you can actually add this picture in. So I'm encouraging you, I'm challenging you, if you are a member of Calvary Bible Church, to upload a picture to your profile. But I want you to hear the reason for this, hear the heart behind this, that we as a church, the members of this church, are committed to helping one another follow Jesus. As we continue to grow as a church, that will become more and more difficult to know who is it that is helping me and who is it that I am to be helping. But as we see these pictures of people who are fellow members here, that's first and foremost an encouragement to each of us. This is someone who cares for me. This is someone who is supporting me. But it's also someone that I am to help them to know more and more of what it's like to be a disciple of Jesus. But we cannot do that if we do not know who one another is. So I encourage you, challenge you, upload a picture to your Planning Center profile. If there's any difficulty of doing so, shoot me an email, and I will be sure to send that email to someone who can actually help you. All right, let's jump into the text, though. We are in our last week of the Gospel of John in 2025. We're going to pick it up in January in chapter 10, but that means that we have all of chapter 9 to cover this morning, and that's quite a bit to go through. But as you look through the chapter, it's all one coherent, cohesive story. It has a beginning, a middle, and an end. So if we were to chop this up over multiple weeks, it would do a disservice to the story. But also, as you read through the story, it's compelling. It's a beautifully written story. There's so much tension. There's this back and forth to it. There's this incredibly merciful healing that Jesus does in the story. There's humor to it. There's so much that goes on in John chapter 9 that if we split this over multiple weeks, we would miss the beauty of the story. Now, here's the hard part with that. Right in the very beginning, in the very first few verses, we are introduced to an idea that is crucial to understand. Jesus touches on this idea that impacts so many lives today that we can preach a whole sermon just on the first few verses of this chapter because of how important of a topic it is. So I don't want to do a disservice to the story itself, but I don't want to miss an opportunity to touch on something that's so important to understand. But I think that as we do so, as we look primarily at the first few verses of this chapter, it can help us understand the flow of the story a little bit better, the impact of the story a little bit better. That as we look at John chapter 9, it addresses three key questions that we ask. The first is, why do we suffer? Second is, what is then our hope? And third is, so how do we live? Why do we suffer? What is our hope? And so how do we live? And we see that, especially the answer to that first question, as we look at how John chapter 9 begins. Let me reread verses 1 through 3 for us. It says, as he, this is Jesus, passed by, he saw a man blind from birth. And his disciples asked him, Rabbi, this is teacher, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind? And Jesus answered, it's not that this man sinned or his parents, but that the work of God might be displayed in him. So the disciples see this man who was born blind, and they ask a question that's pretty common for the day. There was a common belief that they held, and we see it affirmed later on by the religious leaders who basically say the same thing. It was a common belief that what you get out of life is what you put into life. So if you are turning away from God, if you are sinning, then you are going to have a life that's full of hardship and difficulty. But if you are following God well, if you turn to him, then things are going to go well for you. You're going to be blessed. It's going to be an easy life. It was a common belief of the time. Now, the hard part with that is what goes back to what we were talking about last week, that Jesus says that all who, save for those who are saved by God, are slaves to sin, this compulsion to turn away from him. And so if we're saying, who are the people who are getting difficulty and hardship now in this life? Well, we'd have to say it's everybody. Because all sin, all turn away from God. For whom are the people that life goes well and they get blessed? Well, nobody is deserving that blessedness. All sin, all turn away from God. And so it's difficult, in fact, impossible, to make a one-to-one correlation between someone's behavior, someone's ability to follow God, and the events that they go through in their life, whether those are good or bad. Certainly, God speaks of giving blessing to those who follow him, and he speaks of holding all accountable, to judging all wrongdoing, but we don't often see that within this lifetime. Those are ultimate languages. And so the idea that we can tell from someone's circumstances of life of how well they're following God, well, that's foreign to the Bible. In fact, that's an entirely different belief system. That's called karma. And Jesus says there's no place for that within following him. Now, I think this is important to talk about because this has a way of slipping into even modern Christian understanding. It has a way of showing up in how people understand what they're going through. I'm having a really hard time. Things are going really difficult for me. What is it that I did to deserve this? What is it that I did to cause this? That karma has this way of blending in with Christianity like it's a chameleon, and there's no place for that within Christianity. Or on the other side of that, it's this idea of, well, things are going really well for me, and that must be because I go to church on Sundays, I'm reading my Bible all the time, I'm in all those Bible studies, and while those are good things to do, that's never a guarantee as the outcome of it. Christianity is not put the quarter in the slot and you get yummy treats at the end of it. We're never guaranteed that within this life. And what we see instead is that there's never an ability to see within this lifetime if what the circumstances, good or bad, that someone is going through is related to their ability, what it is that they deserve. And so this man is here and he's born blind. He's been suffering in this way since birth. And what Jesus is saying that it's not possible to say that his individual suffering is because of his individual sin. That when brokenness comes into this world, it has the capacity to break everything indiscriminately. And that always comes with the question of why. Why is it this way for some and this way for other people? Why did this man get born blind when there are 13 other people in the story this far who did not experience that? And that's where I have a really big theological answer to those questions always, and it is, I don't know. I have no idea. It's a mystery as to why brokenness comes this way to some and not to others. And that's hard for us to wrap our minds around. We like to have some sense of control, some sense to make sense of it all. And so it's tempting to be able to say, well, I'm going through difficulty because of this right here. This is what caused it. Things are going well for me because I've been doing these good things. There's a sense of control. There's a sense of answering the mystery. We don't like the mystery. But is God so feeble that we can coerce him to work in whichever way we want, for good or bad, by our own actions? No, not at all. Not at all. Instead, what we see is that God blesses those who worship him and those who have no idea that he exists. You also see that suffering and hardship comes into this world, and it doesn't first check people's CVs, doesn't look at their moral compass. It indiscriminately brings difficulty throughout this world. And it's hard to understand why that is. If you've been around Calvary throughout this past year, you might have noticed that this has been an unprecedented year of growth, of numerical growth, that we've had more and more people coming to this church. And it's awesome. It's exciting. We get to see more and more of the work that God does through people's lives as there's just more people around. But with that as well, it comes more and more stories of difficulty, more and more hardship, more pain and sorrow and suffering that people are enduring. And that's really hard. It's really difficult to see the ways that people have been enduring the difficulties of this world. And to add on top of that, to have nothing that makes sense of it. Why is it that when the church gathers around one person to pray for them as they have this health scare, to get good news coming back of words like remission or the test came back negative or positive, whichever one is the good one in this case, The things have been going really well for them, but when the church gathers around another person to pray for them, we don't get that news. Why? Why is it that when this couple, this relationship, this marriage goes through something that could break them, that could dissolve this marriage, destroy it, but they come out on the other side stronger because of it? And yet there's this other relationship who went through something similar and almost immediately ceased to exist, let alone the other relationships that have never needed to go through something like it. Why? Why is it that there are some who've been searching desperately for work, that they really want to work, they want to work hard, they want to earn their way, but it's been month after month of not finding something, when other people found a job quickly, a dream job, right out of the blue, or others who've been able to work in the same place for decades without interruption? Why? Why is it that some families seem to have 6 kids instantly, but we waited 7 years for one? And then there's other couples who look at our waiting and say, man, I wish it was only 7 years. I wish we could have had a stop to our waiting. And my answer always is, I don't know. I don't know. But don't be like the disciples in the story. Don't try to find out who to blame. Don't figure out who is the cause or who's at fault for it, because Jesus says that's not what it is. But instead of just leaving us in the questions of, I don't know why this is happening, he helps to give us the hope that we have that's found in him. Because while I don't know why you're going through what you're going through, whatever that might be, I don't know why this is happening, but I do know what will happen. I do know the source of hope that we can have no matter the hardship that we're going through. And we can get to that in the very way that Jesus does this particular healing. Let me pick up the story in John 9, verse 6. And having said these things, this is Jesus, spit on the ground and made mud with the saliva. And he anointed the man's eyes with the mud and said to him, go wash in the pool of Siloam, which means sent. And he went and washed and came back seeing. Now, I think we can be honest with each other here and say, this is gross. And it's also unnecessary. Like, we've seen Jesus healed just by his very words. Like, he doesn't even need to be around people. And he says, yeah, this guy's healed already. Go back home and you'll see that to be true. And so why does he now spit into the ground and make mud with that saliva and then put that on this man's face? It seems entirely unnecessary. And I think that's a good question. When something is unusual or peculiar, we're to ask, why is this recorded in this way? Why does Jesus do this particular thing? I think that's the right question to be asking. I think there's an answer that we can give to it, but I will preface it by saying it doesn't mean it's less gross or less weird, but I think there's a reason why Jesus does this particular thing. Because what Jesus is doing in this way to bring healing, this restoration to this man, he is using the dirt, the ground that's in front of him to do this work. I think that's supposed to make us recall something from the Old Testament, like John does all the time. Because when you go back to the book of Genesis, when God is creating everything, he is doing so just by the power of his word. He says, let there be this particular thing, and that thing just shows up. Now, there's a difference when God creates humans, and we get to that in the retelling of the creation of humanity in Genesis chapter 2. That what God does in creating the first humans is he goes to the ground, and he forms Adam from the dust. And we're supposed to see in that this really intimate, this really personal, this relational way that God is close to humanity in their making, to show that they are entering into this closeness with God that is so needed for them. And so when Jesus goes to the ground that's in front of him to do this work that he's doing, entirely unnecessary, I think it's supposed to make us recall our very creation, the very way that God makes people. But Jesus isn't here making something brand new. Jesus isn't creating eyes or creating something new that's never been seen before. He's instead addressing a need that this man has. Well, I think it goes to what we see after God created humans. That after forming them from the dust, from the dirt, that we see from that humans turn away from God. And the story goes that sin enters into the world, and all suffering and sorrow and hardship and brokenness and impairments come from that very moment. So when we look at the life of this blind man, we don't say his sin caused his suffering, but we do say sin causes all suffering. Sin enters into the world, and that's what leads to humanity being less than what they were meant for, less than what they ought to have been. That the impairment that this man has is not because of his sin, but it's certainly because of sin in this world. And so what Jesus is doing is addressing that very thing. God created humans to be with him. As sin enters, that's no longer possible. So why has Jesus come? Jesus has come to show salvation. Jesus has come to point us back to God. Jesus has come to enable us to be the people we were always meant to be. In that perfect relationship with God, where there was nothing broken, nothing that pulled us away from him, nothing that impaired or brought sorrow or hardship, Jesus has come to recreate humanity to be who they were always meant to be, to restore us to who we were always meant to be. And we see that as we understand the flow of this story. I mean, think about it from the perspective of this man. He was born blind. He's never been able to see before. He wouldn't know what the color red is. He wouldn't know his parents' faces. He wouldn't know if the food that was given to him while he was begging was good or was rotten, let alone the fact that he had to be begging because he couldn't work, he couldn't see. This is a man who's been suffering, enduring hardship since birth. And the disciples have the audacity to ask, who caused him to deserve this? Who made this happen? Who's at fault for this? And Jesus' response is, why would anyone be at fault for this? What could he have done to cause this while other people did not deserve this very same thing? Now, sin enters this world, brings suffering and sorrow, but God works to restore all people, bringing us back to him. And that is the very work that Jesus is doing here, that he is recreating this man to live in a way that's not full of the marks of a broken and desperate world, but instead reflects the pureness and wholeness that all we're meant to always have. Jesus demonstrates by using the very substance that humanity was created from to show how he is recreating this person to be who he was always meant to be. And we see that the work of Jesus is doing that exact same thing. He is the God who sees the sorrow of this world that humans are enduring that we were never meant for, and so he comes to join with them. He sees humans that are going through the hardships of this world that was never the design, and so he joins in with humanity. He sees people that are going through all of the difficulties of life that were never meant to be there, and so Jesus comes to take those very same things away. That this process of restoration that he does, this recreating work that he does, we're supposed to link it with how humans were made. Jesus is saying, I am bringing people back to who they were meant to be. That's the very same thing that we see at the end of the Bible, that the work that Jesus accomplishes in Revelation 21 speaks to this very idea. It says, then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and the sea was no more. And I saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, behold, the dwelling place of God is with man. He will dwell with them, and they will be his people, and God himself will be with them as their God. He will wipe away every tear from their eyes, and death shall be no more. Neither shall there be mourning, nor crying, nor pain anymore, for the former things have passed away. Why do they need to pass away? Because they're not what we're meant for. They're not in the design. These are not things that we were ever meant to know. But when sin comes into the world, it brings all that pains, all that brings sorrow. But the work of God is here. And he said to who was seated on the throne, behold, I am making all things new. This is what Jesus has come to do, that he is making all things new. He's bringing restoration, making people to be who they always were meant to be, with perfection and goodness and blessedness. This is the hope that we have in this life, that when we know the work that Jesus has already begun doing, the work that Jesus will fully and finally do when he comes back, that is the source of our hope in life. And as people who are full of this hope, the certainty of what Jesus has done and what will do, that's what enables us to live the life that we have now. You and I will continue to go through difficulty and hardship. How do we make it through that? I mean, we know what's coming. We know hard things are coming. How do we make it through what we know will be difficult to navigate? Well, it's only when we know what is ultimately coming, that suffering will never have the last word, that suffering is on a shot clock. It will go away. It will cease to exist because Jesus has come to make us as the people we were always meant to be. That is the hope that we have now. It's the hope that this blind man experienced, that he was sitting there, never being able to see before in his life. But when he was confronted with Jesus, it changed everything. You and I were like that blind man, unable to see, unable to make sense of the difficulty of this life, unable to know what's the purpose of it, what's behind it. And so oftentimes we just point fingers. This must be the cause. This must be the reason. But instead we see Jesus, the God of the universe, join in with us and begin this restoration, this recreating process. And that is the source of our hope. So if that is our hope, how then do we live now? How do we live through all that is hard, all that is difficult? How do we live lives now in response to that hope? Well, I think it looks a bit like the little bit of a life that we get to see from this man after his healing. I said I don't want to do a disservice to this story because it's such a beautiful story, but here is where I need to inappropriately rush too quickly through it to get to the end. But what we see is after Jesus heals this man, things don't necessarily get better for him right away. This man is healed after never being able to see before, and then he meets his neighbors, the people who would have seen him every single day, and they say, well, this can't be the man that we've seen begging before. This must be someone else. And he says, no, it is me. It is me. And the crowd is amazed. They're surprised by this. The idea that a man who was born blind now is able to see. They've never heard of anything like that. I mean, maybe they've seen some miracle workers or they've read stories of how God worked in the past of being able to stop the process of becoming blind. But the idea of someone who was born blind who can now see, that's unprecedented. That's unheard of. Except for one place that was heard of. It was the expected sign of the Messiah, the Christ, the Savior of the world. The book of Isaiah speaks about this in chapters 35 and 42, that this would be the type of work that the one who would come to remake humanity would do. So the crowd gets excited. They take this man to the Jewish religious leaders. See, is this real? Has the Messiah come? Has the Savior of the world come? Is the hope that we have that enables us to endure finally arrived? And so they bring him in front of the religious leaders, and the religious leaders don't think it's true. I mean, for one, this healing was done on the Sabbath. So how can someone truly be from God if they're not following the rules that they think God has set? And so they're interrogating this man and eventually come to the conclusion of, well, it must not be real. It must not be valid. It's a hoax. He was never born blind. So they bring his parents in and say, was he really born blind? And his parents are terrified. They don't want to get on the wrong side of him. They know they don't like Jesus, so they don't want to say something wrong. And so they're like, all we can confirm is that he was born blind. Anything after that, don't ask us. He's old enough. Ask him. He's responsible. He's accountable. Leave us out of it. And so they bring the man back in, and at this point, they are certain. They don't want to find out the truth anymore. They just want to confirm their assumptions. And so they say, Jesus was not a good guy. Prove that. Tell us again of how this happened. And I really like the humor of this man who was once blind. He asks them this question of essentially like, why do you keep asking me all these details? I've told you already. Do you want to hear because you want to follow him? You're just excited about following him, so that's why you want me to keep telling you the story? That makes him really angry. So they kick him out of the synagogue. Now, don't just hear that as you're not welcome to be here today. This means you're not welcome to ever come back. I mean, this man's having the best day of his life. He's never seen before. And now he's being told, you're no longer welcome to worship your God in the way you think God has called you to. But the ever-merciful Jesus hears what has happened and seeks this man out. This is verse 35. Jesus heard that they cast him out, and having found him, he said, do you believe in the Son of Man? This is a title that Jesus uses to refer to himself. Do you believe in me? And he answered, "Who is he, sir, that I may believe in him?" And Jesus said to him, "You have seen him. It is he who is speaking to you." And he said, "Lord, I believe," and worshiped him. We said that the section that we've been in the Gospel of John is when we've just been waiting, desperately waiting for someone to acknowledge who Jesus is, to believe in him. We've had times where we've gotten close, where there's this crowd that seems to be following him, but then they fall away. Finally, we get to a man who sees Jesus for who he truly is. All it took was for him being blind to see him. He acknowledges Jesus. He worships him, not merely because of what he did for him, but he sees that this man, Jesus, this God, is worthy of his worship, worthy of his belief. And so this is the only worthy response. How do we live now? Well, we are people who continue to endure suffering and hardship in this life, not necessarily because of something that we've caused by our own actions, but because this world is not what it's meant to be. But when we have the hope that's possible because of Jesus and the work he has already accomplished and the work that we are certain he will do, we can endure the worst that the world can throw at us. But with that as well, we live with the sort of confidence that this man can have, the sort of acknowledgement of the certainty of that work of Jesus. Now, when I say that the confidence that this man has, that's not he's able to stand in front of this crowd of people who are interrogating him and just answer all their questions, that he's able to give really rhetorical responses. No, as you read through the story as to what this man says, well, his answer almost always is, "I don't know." Who was it that healed you? I don't know. How did he heal you? I don't know. Why did he heal you? I don't know. What do you know? Well, I know what he's done for me. I know he did something that no one else could do. I know he's given me hope and life and belief. And so I know he's worthy of following. Last week, we talked about the marks of a disciple, of what it looks like to be a disciple, to be a follower of Jesus. And one of the ones that we touched on and didn't get into was confident witness. That as people who are following Jesus, we have the confidence to tell others of who this Jesus is and what he's done. Now, that can sound intimidating. That could sound like to be confident, you need to have the answers. To be confident, you need to be able to persuade someone to believe in Jesus. To be confident, you need to be able to just boldly talk about Jesus constantly, like just in the middle of conversations. How was your week? Well, I mean, Jesus saved me, so this week, like that's not what it is. The confidence is the very same confidence that this man has. And I say that as the man who most often said, "I don't know." When we tell others of what Jesus has done for us, it's not because you have the ability to persuade someone. It's not because you have all the right answers. It's because that you are sitting on the rested and completed work of Jesus in the eager anticipation of the work that he will do. This man was on trial, stood in front of them, and had confidence, not because he was able to articulate answers, but because it was rested on what Jesus has done for him. We, as followers of Jesus, go into this world confidently bringing the message of what Jesus has done for this world because the message itself is our confidence. The message itself is what we rely on to bring people into contact with Jesus. That is the basis of our confidence. As we go into this holiday season, this Advent season, it's one of the easiest times of the year to confidently witness to what Jesus has done for us. There's so much imagery about Jesus going on. We're singing songs that have Jesus baked into them, even if we don't acknowledge it. There's so much looking back on this year that was, and oftentimes it's seeing hardship and difficulty and wondering, how do we gear up for the next year? What good could possibly come in the next year? Where is my hope? It's such an easy time to point people to the work of Jesus. And so I encourage you, as we go into this Advent season, to think about who can you show Jesus to? Who can you point to the work that Jesus has done for them in this similar way? It's an easy time to invite to things going on at this church. For those of our women here, women's brunch is such a fun invite opportunity. So I've been told. I've never been invited myself for some reason. But it's such a great opportunity to invite women that you know to hear about the hope that we have in Jesus. Or our Christmas Eve services. To invite to the, it's a time that we get many people who don't typically come to church on a Sunday morning, and so we get to gather together and point each other to the work that Jesus has done for us. We have cards that are on the back table in the lobby or on the Bible table in the back of this room, which just you can easily hand out to one or two or half a dozen people with just an invite to, this is what our church is doing, would love to be with you on Christmas Eve. Or maybe coming into church is intimidating. We have a guy stand in front and he's really scary looking, and so maybe it's easier to invite people into your homes just to live normally next to them. Not to create a whole Bible study to convince them to believe, but just to get to see the hope lived out of your life. Invite them over to dinner. And maybe it's as simple as if you're part of a family is, hey, just wanted to let you know as we're going into dinner, one of the traditions that we have around Advent is our church gives us an Advent activity that we could do together as a family. And so we do that after dinner and would love for you to be with us. You don't have to participate if you're not comfortable to, but this is what we do as a family to remember the importance of this time of year. There's nothing invasive about that. It's inviting people to join in with what's important to you. And our confidence is not on your ability to get them to do what you think is good for them, but to point to the work that Jesus has done for them. Well, why do we do this? Why is this what I'm sending us off to do? Think of who to be witnesses to. Well, because our story is very similar to like this blind man. I was once unable to see. Unable to see why do we endure these difficult things. Unable to see what is my possible hope for continuing to press on. Unable to see what is the purpose of this life. What is the meaning of what we go through? Why am I here? I was unable to see so much. But Jesus came to me. And he opened my eyes. And I still don't see all that well. I still fumble and mess up and have difficulty. And I don't feel very confident at times. But I can point back to the work that Jesus has done, that he has accomplished, that he has built my entire life upon, that he will do, and so I can press on. And as I go out in the world, I'm surrounded by people who cannot see yet. And so this Advent season, who can we pointing? Who can be encouraging? Who can we be helping to see Jesus? Let me pray for us. Father, going through this Gospel of John has been such a gift in August, September, October, and now through most of November. And what a joy it is that we are not calling an end to the Gospel of John. We're just pausing, that we get to be back in it, to be encouraged by the work that you've done. But we want to pause for this season, that Advent is a time that we look at your coming, that you have come into this world, and so we can know the certainty that you will come back, that you have begun the work of opening the eyes of the blind, and you will fully and completely recreate all of creation to be as it was always meant to be. What you began in your earthly ministry, we will see fully complete one day. And as people who rush from thing to thing to thing, as people who fill up our December calendars, we want to intentionally pause and say, remember. Remember where our hope is. Remember what's on the horizon. Remember what's coming. Because that shapes and changes how we live now. We are people of hope. We are people who have been given life. And we are people who help others to experience and know that same thing. So it's you and you alone we pray.